Yeah. Namaha. Hello. Good afternoon, good evening. Huge love and excitement to see you all here, to experience you all here. I'm Sally, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to our first gathering of 2021 and our third class in the Extraordinary Wisdom of the Yoga Sutra. I've called this class the Inner Path of the Yoga Sutra because the sutras in this text are all about the inward-facing aspects of practice. They're the states you enter when you follow the steps described in earlier chapters and begin to sink into deep meditation. So in the next 5 weeks, we're going to enter into the inner path of meditation, and we're also going to unpack some of the more esoteric practices in this tradition. But the main thing I want to offer you and that I want to really encourage you is to allow the course to help you curate your practice for the next 5 weeks. In other words, to let the homework assignments and the lectures not only be sources of information, but actually become the inspiration to let you go deeper. So, you know, my experience of meditation and spiritual practice is that there almost always needs to be an intellectual structure for the practice. In other words, the structure, and that's one of the reasons why we work with text, will help explain your experience, it will inspire you, it'll show you the reasons why you want to take internal practice seriously. And also it will fill your mind with samskaras of truth, which especially in this particular moment are really important because the samskaras of untruth, pure falsehood, or what people these days call post-truth, whatever that means, are so prevalent in the culture, especially in the United States right now. When we study books 1 and 2 during 2020, many of you, and certainly me, found that it provided a powerful counterpoint to the situation we were facing in the physical world. The combination of the pandemic, of course, our personal experience of the pandemic, and even more to the point, the upheavals in society, possibly in our family, in the political situation that we were experiencing. So one of my intentions in creating this class was to allow all of us to take refuge in the eternal truths of the yogic path. Because when push comes to shove, when the world seems to be falling apart, really, it's only our practice that helps us build the mental and emotional and physical power that we need. Yes, relationships help. The food we eat helps. Yes, exercise helps. Gratitude practice helps. There are many, many ways that we can help our mind become more like Teflon to the things that go on in the outer world. But truly speaking, the secret that the yoga traditions offer us is that the only thing that really protects our mind and our heart from the upheaval of what the yoga sages call the burning ocean of the world is our practice and our cultivation. So in Tantra, which is our essential orientation, as many of you know, part of what we do is cultivate an attitude of non-duality, the understanding that one consciousness is present in all phenomena. The Tantric view, as I said earlier, is non-dualistic, meaning that it sees spirit fully present in the material world, no matter how things seem. Classical yoga philosophy, which is the basis of the Yoga Sutra, is actually dualistic in that it sees an absolute separation between matter, which the text tells us arises within the field of energy called prakriti, or nature, as it's usually translated, and spirit, which is seen as a transcendent witness. However, one thing that I have noticed since beginning my deep study of these sutras is that yoga philosophy has evolved. You know, the Yoga Sutras come from, they're actually very old. They're more or less contemporaneous with Buddhism, which means that they emerged between 800 and 500 BC. And Tantra is much more modern. It arose in around the 6th century of the Common Era. And like early Buddhism, with which it is contemporaneous, as we said, yoga philosophy has evolved, and in that process begun to be infused with tantric and devotional, and also elements from the Puranas, the mythological tradition of India. So Tantra, many people believe, and I include myself, is actually the advanced course for both yoga and Buddhism. Tantric yoga and tantric Buddhism being are more modern, more evolved, and in many ways evolved as human consciousness evolved, as it became more sophisticated and also more complicated. And a part of the realization that began to become a part of this tradition, and which we very much emphasize in our practice, in our courses, is that the same truths, the inner truths realized through meditation, are actually accessible in the open-eyed world. And once you've had this insight, once you've realized that spirit infuses the physical world, you can't really go back to believing that spirit is different than matter. You actually become able to feel the subtle creativity and fluidity of physical experience, moment to moment, even when your eyes are open and you're engaged in activities, because you experience the continuity between the clarity and wisdom and intuition and love that you might have entered into in a meditative state while you're in the ordinary waking consciousness. And this is what gives you the resilience and the power that's both the worldly fruit of yoga and is also the prerequisite, really, for a full transformation of your consciousness. But that insight has to be earned again and again through practice. We need to regularly shut our eyes, turn our attention into the body, focus precisely enough to allow our ordinary distractions and identities to dissolve. And that's why the Yoga Sutra is so indispensable, not only because it's an actual cookbook for yoga practice, especially the practice of Raja Yoga, which is, Raja means king of yoga, it means the royal yoga, because Raja Yoga is considered to be the highest transformation of yoga practice. And the Yoga Sutra maps out the process of inner focus so precisely, defining and guiding us and moving through the different layers and principles of the inner world. And it also is a real kick-butt text for pointing out the no-excuses path. So, as I said, I'm recommending that you use these classes as jumping-off points for your practice. You'll be getting weekly homework assignments and some guided meditations, both for meditation and also for study points, contemplative exercises, so that, you know, if you do them, you'll actually get a much more granular and experiential understanding of not only what the text is saying, but also of your own practice and of the stages in your own practice. So we'll also be doing quite a lot of meditation in this class, initially working with several different practices for short periods, but as we go on, the meditation sessions will become longer. And I'm going to suggest that you commit to meditating for half an hour every day, at least once a day while the course is going on, as well as to kind of snacking, meditative and contemplative snacking all through the day. As you know, being regular in your practice is what makes it most transformative. As you regularly sit for meditation, the combination of contemplation, study, and inner practice will kindle insight and realization, which are the only forms of knowledge that really work to change consciousness. So, you know, the words that we're saying here hopefully will sink in and help align you more deeply with the inner world But for this to happen, we need the silent practice. And yet, silent practice also needs the support of the teachings. So the combination of practice, that is meditation practice, contemplative practice, and study are two of the real supports for our transformation. So let's start with the bhavana, a creative contemplation. So you can begin to find your posture, feeling the touch of your buttocks and thighs on the seat, inhaling down to into the lower body, allowing the torso to rise up from this grounded base. Allow yourself, your attention to come to the breath, which is always the engine, as it were, the support for taking us from our external focus into inner focus. And as you gently focus on the breath, consider this truth. My mind is the divine mind. Though my experience, my inner experience, is colored by what I see and hear and think, its nature is pure divine awareness. My mind is the divine mind. Though my attention is often outgoing, limited by identifying with my individual body and mind, it is the divine mind that is holding all that I experience. The wisdom, the love, the truth that I experience in my inner world are the wisdom and love and truth that is the source of all this. I am that source, whether I know it or not. My consciousness is divine consciousness. My mind is the divine mind. And with that understanding, with that recognition, we'll begin to become aware of ourselves as part of this virtual sangha, and we'll take ourselves to the lake, to the blue lake of consciousness, which both symbolizes the juicy, rasa-filled wisdom that arises from the heart of the inner world, and also symbolizes the gathering that we create together. There are about 200 of us in this course. Many of you are live, others are participating through the audio download that will be available tomorrow. We come from 5 continents and several time zones. So right now, as you sit, as you feel your presence here, become aware that we are sitting around the beautiful, transparent, translucent, luminous lake of consciousness, the divine lake of the mind. Feel that you're surrounded by brothers and sisters, fellow sadhakas, and also by the others in your life, people who matter to you, people who, whom you experience as part of your inner tribe. Perhaps family members, friends, sadhana mates from other times in your life. Your eyes are closed, and you're holding in your hands a candle. The candle is in a jeweled holder. And as you look at the candle, you recognize that it holds your deepest intention, not only for your own transformation, but also for the upliftment of the world. And as you focus on creating an intention, on holding the intention that will not only uplift your consciousness, not only uplift the consciousness of the people that your life touches, but also uplift the consciousness of the world itself. So our intention here, speaking for myself, my intention, I'll say, is that all of us be deeply immersed in the inner heart of consciousness, that our immersion be of benefit to all beings, that our immersion be of benefit to all beings. And as we make this intention, as we make this affirmation of intention, we bring the candle in its jeweled holder to the heart, and we offer it to the lake. As we offer it to the lake, we ask that it be fulfilled. May our practice uplift us. May it carry us further into our journey of enlightenment. May it give us wisdom, comfort, and peace in this difficult time. May it enable us to be of help to others. You can place your hands in Chin Mudra, or you can place your right hand over the center of your chest, your left hand over that, and feel the connection between your palms and the heart. We'll chant Om three times. Then we'll chant the Om Namah Shivaya Gurave mantras. And we'll end with the traditional Patanjali invocation mantras. Shivaya Gurave Sat Chit Ananda Murtaye Nishprapanchaya Shantaya Niralambaya Tejase. Salutations to the Eternal Teacher who exists within us as pure presence, pure awareness, pure joy, who is peaceful, luminous, beyond forms, who is never not supporting us. And now the traditional Patanjali invocation mantras, I'm going to sing them in the traditional tune. One day, Guru Nam Charanaravinde Sandarshita Swatma Sukhava Bodhe Nishreyase jangalikaya mane Sansara hala hala moha shankhe Abahu purushakaram Shankha chakra siddharinam Sahasra shira samshvetam Pranamami Patanjalim. I bow to the lotus feet of the gurus, to the awakening happiness of one's own self revealed, supremely good, acting as the miracle healer of pacifying delusion and the poison of samsara, taking the form of a man serpent holding a conch, a discus, and a sword with 1,000 heads, white in color. To Patanjali, I offer my salutations. Now, as you sit, allow yourself to feel the presence of each other and of the energy emanating from the Great Lake. Allow yourself to be breathed. Allow yourself to become fully receptive to the prana shakti that moves through every particle of this universe. And with each inhalation, feel that you draw in wisdom and light and power. And with each exhalation, feel that you let go of worry, of fear, of holding, of distraction. Many of you here have been present during the last two series of classes, and I want to say for those of you who weren't, we're going to be making the first couple of lectures of the first course available because they have some of the introductory material in them, the material that introduces us to the Yoga Sutra as, let's say, a philosophical text with its own context. But right now, I'd like to just spend a moment putting the text in the context of Indian philosophy in general. We're going to spend just a couple minutes doing a mini overview of the schools of philosophy in Indian thought. Indian philosophy normally deals with a particular range of topics. Great works of Indian thought, the Bhagavad Gita, the Upanishads, the texts of Vedanta, and the texts of Tantra, and certainly the texts of Yoga and Sankhya, always start out with metaphysics, establishing their sense of the relationship between spirit and matter. They look into the causes of the universe, how it works, and they also, and this is crucial to all these texts, of course, they provide a view of the path to enlightenment, or salvation. So the hallmark of Indian philosophy is that unlike Western philosophical thought, it's never simply speculative, though it does deal with the topics that Western philosophy deals with, ontology, the nature of being, epistemology, how we know what we know, psychology. But the main focus is always on how we can be liberated from suffering and sorrow. The philosophical term for this is soteriology, the science of liberation, of salvation. As most of you know, it's not an accident that the word for philosophy in Sanskrit is darshana, which literally means seeing, usually seeing or knowing the divine. And in other words, most Indian philosophy wants to show you the route to seeing the divine, whether as your own self, which this text does, or in the case of some of the devotional texts, seeing God as Ishvara, as goddess, as the the being who is seen in devotional traditions as the source of the universe, but which always leads you back to the light of your own being. The purpose of the Yoga Sutra, as all the great texts, is self-realization. Freedom and fullness. In Tantra, it's said that the purpose of this world is bhoga and moksha, that is, experience, which is the school within which we come to understand who we are, and moksha, liberation from everything that limits us. And though the methods and the levels of development of these texts aren't always completely congruent, they all have some very significant qualities in common, probably because they're true. The first, I already mentioned, that the goal is liberation. The second is that each of these traditional texts, these traditional paths, offers a coherent theory of everything based on the perception that behind the physical world, beyond the physical world, are realms of subtlety which are prior to and causative of the physical world. The third thing they have in common is this, is the understanding that the process of liberation happens in the mind. Known in Sanskrit as the citta, citta means a miniaturized awareness. In the Sanskrit language, the word for absolute consciousness is chit, feminine form chitti, and the citta, the mind stuff, the material of the mind, is considered to be our individualized form of that awareness, which is intrinsically creative and filled with power, just like your mind. And the mind, when it is turning our attention towards limitation, when it's filling itself with the material that comes in over the transom of our doors and windows, as it were, can be the source of intense happiness and intense suffering. And it's also, on the deeper level, the source of freedom from suffering. And this is, of course, the most important aspect of practical yoga philosophy. And it's also one of the main truths that the West took from the East, and which has begun to inform what people in the media world call the wellness space of contemporary life. It's really based, the wellness practices of our contemporary 2021 world are all to some large extent based on the same insight, which is that the mind is the source of limitation and suffering, and mind is also the source of freedom. So the Yoga Sutras, begins with one core truth, yogas citta vritti nirodaha. In yoga, we work to dissolve, I'm paraphrasing here, the movement in the mind, the movements that obscure the underlying nature of the mind, so that the witness consciousness, which is the subtlest aspect of our being, can be seen. Otherwise, the seer, this innate awareness, identifies with the body and with thoughts and with anything that shows up in our field. So yoga is one of the six so-called orthodox darshanas, the orthodox philosophies, which are all based on the Vedas and which are considered to be revealed texts. That is, texts that come directly from source, filtered through the minds of sages and priests. Tantra is also revealed, but it's not from the Vedic stream. It comes from a tradition called Agama, which is said to have originated in the wisdom of Shiva. But as you may know, Shiva is actually the deity of yoga, so that particular orientation is very much a part of the tradition of the Yoga Sutras. All these systems, all the Indian systems of Indian philosophy, describe the universe as a condensation of infinitely subtle and creative mind stuff, which manifests sequentially through a series of stages, which are called tattvas, stages becoming increasingly dense. The word tattva literally means thatness, and it refers to the quality of experience, the essential elemental experience available at certain levels, different levels of physical manifestation. And in yoga, there are, in the yoga philosophy system, which is based on Sankhya, one of the other six philosophies, there are 25 such levels, the subtlest being pure spirit, which in yoga is called Purusha, which is the eternal witness of the world, and Prakriti, which is the energetic matrix of everything that exists. In Tantra, there are 11 levels of consciousness, 11 tattvas above Purusha, culminating in the infinite non-dual awareness of love that Tantra calls Shiva Shakti. So in Tantra, both consciousness and matter, both spirit and matter, are said to be contained in the great field of Shiva Shakti. And liberation in Tantra dissolves the spirit-matter split as you reach higher stages of meditation. One of the reasons that we say that Tantra is a more evolved path than yoga is precisely because the sages of Tantra discovered these higher stages of consciousness. However, up to that 25th tattva, everything that the Yoga Sutra gives us is phenomenally useful in our practice and in our understanding about ourselves. And, of course, the Purusha Prakriti formulation is absolutely subject to experience and hopefully very much a part of what all of us experience as we, as our consciousness flows into greater and greater stages, states, tattvas. Prakriti is a subtle energy. I know this is a review for some of you, but there's something about talking about these concepts even very quickly and briefly that starts to bring them online for us. The Prakriti is a subtle energy within and beyond matter, and you can think of it, you know, as this vast ocean of endless waves of experience that arise and subside, and within which forms and structures and feelings and ideas are constantly being created, held, and dissolved, within which infinite diversity arises. And it, within Prakriti, you know, which is an undivided subtle substance, the three gunas, the three qualities that are in constant motion at play every single fraction of a moment, the quality of equanimity or sattva, of activity or rajas, and stasis, known as tamas, which combine and recombine to create every level of manifest reality, including within our own psyche. And, you know, again, this is just to review the terms. The human psyche, which, according to all of the yoga systems, is really the source not only of our inner experience, but also of the appearance of the so-called external world, which yoga tells us is actually produced by Prakriti through our psychic instruments. One of these days, I promise you, you'll have an experience of how that's true. So the overall energetic mind stuff, as I said earlier, is called citta. The part of the mind that is able to see to the heart of everything, the objective awareness of the mind, is called buddhi, which actually means, literally means, awakened mind stuff, and is usually translated as the intellect, because part of its function is to give you objective readings of reality. The third aspect of the mind stuff is called the ahamkara, or the ego, which is the function that divides our experience of life into what belongs to me and what belongs to others. So it's the source of our feeling of individuality, and the part of the world that collects data about the part of the mind that collects data about the world is called manas, or the sense mind, because it's in constant connection with the information that comes in through the inner and outer senses. And here I want to quote the scholar David Gordon White. He says, the mind stuff, the citta, is the mirror in which the luminous witness sees itself. Now think about what that means. The mind stuff is the mirror in which the luminous witness sees itself. So, in other words, the Purusha, your pure awareness, your pure consciousness, is always filtering its experience of itself through the contents of the citta. And White says, but that mirror is a funhouse mirror, altering its shape, form, size, and quality in every moment. Its flux is the result of the mind's ever-changing reaction to sensory stimuli, erroneous conceptions, passions, emotions, memories, whether immediate memories or past life memories, and so forth. These, David White says, are what the Yoga Sutra calls the vrittis, or fluctuations of the mind stuff. All through our life, the mind is constantly taking on the form of whatever it perceives. This is such a hard idea to grasp because we completely believe that what we see is reality. And of course, even contemporary physics, at least certain aspects of the world of contemporary physics, recognizes that what we see is not actually what's there. One great physicist, Donald Kaufman, says that the forms we see both in the mind and in the so-called outer world are actually icons, like the icons that appear on your computer, that allow us to perceive what is actually a field of essentially undifferentiated energy. So the mind does this trick of forming energy into forms, and that's what we experience. And your entire life experience is actually a result of these mental processes mediated through the psychic instruments, buddhi, ahamkara, and manas. Whatever appears in the mind causes the mind to take on the form of that object, and that's why when what appears in the mind is agitation, you experience yourself as completely or partially agitated. Whatever the mind focuses on, it becomes that, which means that you become whatever the mind focuses on. Normally, the body, the mind, and thoughts and emotions. But what that means is that day to day, moment to moment, the state of your physical body, your emotional state, and your thoughts and opinions are filtering reality and completely determining your experience of who you think you are. But to me, and this is really the major point that's the heart of the whole yogic enterprise, the mind stuff, the citta, because it shares the creativity of the absolute mind, the God mind, is so creative and so versatile that it's also capable of taking any form, including the form of the true self. So in Tantra, again, the mind stuff is understood to be pure creative power. In yogic terms, citta is your individual form of prakriti, constantly transforming itself according to which one of the gunas is predominant. So when sattva guna is predominant in the mind, you feel happy, free, pure. When raja guna is predominant in the mind, you feel active, dynamic, ambitious, passionate. And when tamaguna is predominant in the mind, you feel sleepy, dull, and often, filled with a kind of dull anger, dull pain, dull suffering. So when the citta is drawn away from identifying with the vrittis through practice and detachment, abhyasa and vairagya, it can become so subtle that it experiences itself as pure awareness. It can take the form of deities. It can reveal itself as pure light. And this is the true good news of yoga, your own mind, which normally nails you to the cross of endless thinking, can, through yoga, become the vehicle of extraordinary expansion, bliss, and truth. Because as Vedanta points out, consciousness plus thoughts is the mind. Consciousness minus thoughts is God. Consciousness plus thoughts is the mind. Consciousness minus thoughts is God. We're going to do a meditation which in the Yoga Sutra is called Tattva meditation, and it will be familiar to you because we do it in different forms pretty much, you know, in every course I teach. It's one of my favorite meditations. And it's the practice of withdrawing your attention through the different phases of your personal experience. So you can find a posture, and you know, because we've been practicing in the last course, and we'll be practicing in this one with the eight stages of getting into meditation, we're going to start with yama. We'll start with the yamas and niyamas, or just with one of them. So as you begin your practice, as you begin your sitting, surrender your body to the seat. This is one of the niyamas called surrender to God, surrender to Ishwara, Ishwara Pranidhan. And we can do it with the body as well as with the mind. So have the feeling that you're surrendering your buttocks to the seat, to the cushion. You're surrendering your mind to the process of meditation. You're surrendering your will to the action of Shakti, the action of Prakriti. And ask in a devotional way that this practice that we're about to do reveal its essence to you. You're seated firmly. Your inhalation lets your buttocks and thighs sink into the seat. Your exhalation allows the torso to rise upward through the crown. Your chest lifts and opens. So as you sit in the asana, feel that the asana is the focal point of your practice. Be aware of the different sensations of buttocks against the seat, of the air against your face, of the clothes against your skin. Are there any tickles? Are there any parts of the body that feel tight? Just notice them. There's no need to change anything. Now, as you allow the mind, as you allow your attention to flow through the body, also become aware of any sounds that you hear, the ambient sounds of the room around you, perhaps the internal sounds, part of your attention is in the body, on the body, noticing the sensations on the surface of the skin. Noticing the sensations inside the nostrils, in the roof of the mouth. Noticing where your tongue is, how your eyelids touch one another. And also noticing the sounds around you, sounds within you. I'm aware now, if you haven't already, of the flow of the breath. Just sensing the movement of the breath as it comes into the tip of the nose feeling that the flow of breath is actually painting the nostrils. Sensation of the breath inside the nostrils, flowing over the surfaces there, flowing through the nasal passages. You're not trying to direct the breath, just noticing how it flows right now. Notice the vrittis, the thoughts that are arising and subsiding. Maybe many, maybe very few. Just be aware that thoughts and images appear and disappear within the mind. Now very gently bring your attention to that part of your mind that is aware of these levels of experience, the knower, the witness, the seer. And see if you can notice how attention is actually able to cycle from awareness of sound to awareness of sensation to awareness of breath. To awareness of thinking. To the innermost part of yourself in your waking state, which is the awareness itself, knowing itself. In our practice of the yoga of meditation, Raja Yoga, what we discover is that every one of these facets of experience can actually serve as a doorway into samadhi, into the depths of meditation. A sound, bodily sensations, which we'll be practicing with in a few minutes, breath, a thought of vritti, and awareness itself. So these components of your experience are not just aspects of your individuality. They are doorways into the experience of discovering what you are beyond your individuality. Let yourself segue from sound to sensation, to sensation of breath, to awareness of thinking, to awareness of awareness. And the name of this process that we're doing, different names for it, but in terms of the sequence of yoga practice, what we're doing is a form of pratyahara, the process of withdrawing the mind, coaxing the mind to turn inward. Pratyahara is the fifth of the eightfold practices of yoga, which you'll remember from our last class and from your previous study, because I know many of you are very experienced yoga students. They begin with yama and niyama, the ethical disciplines, which are really the core preparatory practices for the revolution in consciousness that yoga is meant to give us. Asana, the steady, still posture. Pranayama, which refers not only to the actual process of breathing, but actually to the deep refinement of breath that begins to occur in the process of cultivating your own prana. And pratyahara, which through the sequential unfoldment of these processes actually draws the mind, the attention, draws the attention inward. And at this point, as we enter into book 3 of the Yoga Sutra, we enter into what are called the internal practices, the ones that lead directly into meditation, dhyana, dharana and samadhi, actually, dhyana and samadhi. If you remember, in book 1, which we studied in the April course, we're given many different ways to focus the mind, to experience samadhi, including breathwork, mantra, cultivating qualities that help us focus. In book 2, we worked quite specifically with Ashtanga Yoga, and we ended with Pratyahara, with that moment when we draw the mind inward. These are the sutras that we're going to be working with tonight, and which are three of the most famous sutras in the whole yoga tradition. Sutras 1, 2, and 3 of Book 3. Book 3, by the way, is known as the Bhutipada, which refers to a lot of what we're going to be talking about in the next few weeks. The Bhutis are psychic powers. They're the yogic superpowers that begin to come online as we cultivate deeper states of meditation. These powers are sometimes known as siddhis. They are the fruits of deep yogic practice. And the Yoga Sutra gives a lot of space to the practices for acquiring siddhi. The reason being, I've come to realize that when we begin inner practice, we will inevitably develop superpowers, because that development of latent abilities is one of the natural fruits of yoga. And so the Yoga Sutra, which essentially tries to describe every aspect of the path of yogic practice, naturally deals with what the experience of opening up to these inner powers are. And the truth is that these vibhutis, these powers, are not only part of what we developed through practice, it is actually through the cultivation of inner power that we're able to make progress. So the siddhis that matter, the bhutis, the powers that matter, are actually the powers that help us to flow more deeply inward, that allow our consciousness to expand. And so the practices of the, you know, of that are described in the first three sutras are really the basis for everything, else. So here they are. Desha bandhash chitasya dharana. Concentration or dharana is the confining of the mind to a particular limited area. Concentration or dharana, we're going to use the Sanskrit for these concepts because it's actually, the word concentration is misleading, and the more we come to really contemplate the meaning of the word dharana, the more we understand what this phase of meditation really is. So dharana is the confining of the mind to a particular limited area. The second sutra is tatra pratyayeka nata dhyanam, uninterrupted flow of the mental content towards the object is dhyana. Dhyana is sometimes translated as contemplation, sometimes translated as meditation. What dhyana really is the experience that arises when your concentration, your dharana, brings forth the natural inward flow, which I call the meditation current. That is, the aspect of your energy that wants to carry the mind more deeply inward. Concentration is the first step. When you get to dhyana, what it means, especially in a tantrically based path, what it means is that the flow of the meditation current has started to turn the mind inward, as I hope it's doing now. And the third sutra, tad evartamatra nirbhasam swarupa shunyam iva samadhihi. Dhyana, when there is only awareness of the object of meditation without the sense of being a separate self, this same dhyana becomes known as samadhi, or immersion in the subtle essence of mind. And then the fourth sutra, which we're going to go into in detail next week, trayam ekatra samyamaha. These three together constitute samyama. So these four sutras describe the process that happens as we meditate. And what I hope you see and what we're going to explain is that even though the sutras give the impression that they are three separate, distinct, sequential activities, the truth is that they are simply phases of the process that starts when we sit with the intention to meditate. We start by centering our focus, which, as you know, is normally all over the map. This is dharana. This activates the inner current of meditation. Attention starts to sink inward, and the object of focus more and more begins to take over the inner space until we're fully absorbed in it. The classical commentary on the sutra by the famous sage Vyasa says that the proper focus of yoga dharana is on particular spaces in the body. You know, and in these classes, we've been following this model, meditating on centers in the head as well as in the heart, and we're going to continue to do this. The state places of concentration that Vyasa speaks of are basically the chakras, the center of the, around the perineum, the center above the pubic bone, the center around the navel, the subtle heart lotus, the Ajna chakra, center of the head, the tip of the nose, the tongue, the soft palate, and other spots in the body. And what the secret of these spaces is that they're not simply physical. They're not dead matter. In other words, not that matter is dead. That's part of our point here. They're powerful doorways into awareness, simply because the body itself is constructed out of non-material energy, the energy of prakriti or shakti, and built into it are these vortexes, these vortices, which actually serve as portals that open us up past the physicality of the body into its innate energy. And, of course, we also can use words as well as external objects for concentration, including visual symbols like yantras, images from nature, the face of an enlightened being, or, as Sutra 39 in Book 1 says, anything you like, wherever your mind finds satisfaction, is a proper object of concentration. And, of course, as the mind becomes subtler, it becomes possible to meditate entirely on awareness itself, which is what we were kind of cultivating in that first meditation that we did. We're going to be practicing in tonight's gathering on one of these spaces, which is to say the space of the soft palate, which many of you are familiar with because we have worked with it in previous courses. And the reason that we're returning to it today is because many of us have actually cultivated this space to the point where it really has begun to open to us. And those of you who haven't done this practice are going to quickly catch on to it. This is a classical, absolutely classical practice of tantric yoga. And it's the soft palate, which I'm going to ask you to find it. The way I like to do it is to curl my tongue back so that the tip of the tongue moves past the dome of the palate, which is hard, and just finds the space behind the hard palate where the soft palate starts. And it's called the soft palate because it's soft. So you can also use your finger to find it. And the point of this is actually just to give you, you know, a physical experience so that you can focus on it. Then please return your tongue to the floor of your mouth if you don't leave your tongue there. So the soft palate, you might remember, is the portal to a spiritual center known as the Talu Chakra, the palatal chakra. And the Talu Chakra is itself the doorway into the Ajna, the center, the chakra in the center of the head, which is the portal to the expanded mind and the key to subtle states where the coverings that keep us from seeing the light that's what we're made of actually begin to dissolve. We'll start by consciously breathing into this space, into the Talu. So see if you can focus some part of your attention on the soft palate, just to keep it in your awareness. And begin to breathe as you would in ujjayi breath, making a little bit of a sound with the breath. And as in ujjayi, you restrain the glottis, the throat, and so that the air begins to move up towards the soft palate gently and slowly. So the air, of course, is coming in through the nostrils. Inhale with the feeling that the air flowing through your nostrils is moving upward towards the soft palate, and then let it move through the soft palate beyond it as though you're drawing the breath upward through the brain all the way to the crown. And then exhale and let your attention descend through the soft palate. And back out through the nostrils. So we're starting here with a pranayama, approach. Following the breath as it flows in through the nostrils. Feeling the sensuality of the breath touching the nostrils. Feeling it flow upward into the soft palate. And then continuing the inhalation as it rises up through the center of the head to the crown. And then exhale. And let the breath descend back down to the soft palate and out the nostrils. As you enjoy the sensation of the breath softly striking the soft palate and then flowing up through the center of the head into the crown and flowing down past the soft palate, through the nasal passages, out the nostrils. See if you can sense more and more closely the region within the head that opens as you focus here. So as the breath flows in through the nostrils, touching the soft palate, and then flows upward into the center of the head up to the crown, and flows downward with the exhalation, what you may begin to notice is that the breath wants to stay, wants to remain in the center of the head. Focusing first on the soft palate, the Tala Chakra, with the inhalation. Now allow your attention to nestle in the space just above the Tala Chakra, just underneath the skull in the very center of the head, the Agni Chakra. Begin to feel that this space inside the head is the center of your consciousness. And the breath is flowing very easily and naturally. It's flowed up past the Talu chakra and into the center of the head. And it's nestled in the Ajna. The breath is now just rising and subsiding on its own. And your awareness moves through the Ajna chakra, finding the upper limit of the space, the sides, the bottom, and as you allow the breath to help you cultivate comfort and ease in this inner space, feel that now the inhalation begins from the Ajna chakra, and then as you continue to inhale, feel the flow of your awareness moving up till it reaches the crown. And then without any pause, exhale as you descend from the crown to the Ajna chakra. The inhalation flowing from the Ajna to the crown, the exhalation flowing from the crown to the Ajna. Let your focus center more and more fully inside the Ajna, moving with the breath from the Ajna to the crown, from the crown to the Ajna. Take a deep breath in. Inhaling into the Ajna chakra, and now exhale, feeling that your attention descends from the Ajna chakra to the spiritual heart in the center of the chest. Inhale again, feeling that the breath flows into the Ajna chakra. Exhale and feel that the breath descends through the heart to the space beneath the sternum deep inside the body. As soon as the exhalation, as the inhalation is complete, allow the exhalation to rise to the Ajna. And this is your practice for this moment. The inhalation flows in and opens the luminous space of the Ajna chakra. The exhalation flows the breath down to the center of the heart. You inhale upward into the Ajna, downward into the center of the heart. breath is now beginning to flow on its own. Thoughts may be arising because this is dharana. This is the dharana part of the process. You take very seriously the process of letting go of the thoughts as they arise. And allowing your focus to flow from the center of the head to the center of the heart. Not trying to tightly control it, but allowing it to happen naturally. This is dharana. You gradually zero in on the focal point, which creates what we could call a dominant vritti. That's what, in this context, the breath, the focus on the talu chakra, the ajna with its innate luminosity, the movement of the breath between center of the head and the center of the heart. These are dominant vrittis, concrete sensations or thoughts, which gather the other thoughts and sensations. And there's a great image that of a magnet with iron filings. You know, when you put a magnet on over a table in which there are a lot of scattered iron filings, the magnet will attract the filings and they all come together and join the magnet. That's what dharana does. By the way, the vritti we use for dharana can be anything. Famously, in the 70s, when the Harvard Mind-Body Project began to experiment with relaxation techniques, they used a word, and the word they used was book. So you can use anything. But if you choose the object of meditation wisely, which all the traditional teachers will say to you, the object of meditation, the object of dharana, will be one that has innate spiritual power, as the ajna chakra and the heart do, so that they begin to draw your attention inward naturally. And, you know, if you meditate on the soft palate, on the ajna, thinking that it's just a body part, it'll take a while for the practice to reveal itself. Similarly with a mantra, if you see a mantra as just a word without realizing the innate spiritual power, the shakti within it, then your mantra practice will be mechanical. So the key to dharana is to approach the practice, the focal point, with the understanding that its physical aspect, the place in the body, the letters of the mantra, the form of the yantra, are simply the shell, and that within it there's a hidden power which will reveal itself as you stay with it. And at a certain point, the object will stop being a separate structure in the mind as you keep returning to the dharana, the object, the dhriti, again and again, it begins to color the mind so that it becomes the sole contents of your citta. And this is usually the point at which the natural meditation current, which is the true agent of your practice, starts to kick in. And those subtle shifts take place as the object of your focus eliminates the other vrittis, and you begin to be immersed in dhyana. In some of the explanations of the way these three aspects of meditation work, it's said that in dharana, our awareness of the object might last for 12 seconds before a thought comes in. But in dhyana, our awareness of the object is 48 seconds. But in my experience, trying to count the number of seconds that you're focused is not just pointless, but not really helpful. Because even 12 seconds of really deep focus is going to expand your consciousness. So the sutra on dhyana says, tatra pratyaya kamata dhyanam. And the word pratyaya is significant here. It's a technical term that refers to the total content of the mind at any moment. And if you're not out of meditation, if you're still in a trance-like state, please don't worry about it. One of the reasons that I ask you to listen to the lecture another time during the course of the week is because sometimes in the live session, you just go out or go into meditation, you don't hear what I'm saying. But so we're talking now about pratyaya, the contents of the mind. And this is a crucial concept because the Yoga Sutra agrees that your mental content is what organizes your sense of being. So if you're thinking about impeaching Donald Trump or why your teenage daughter has been on the phone for the last 5 hours, that's going to organize your sense of being, and not necessarily in a great way. So the way we hold the pratyaya determines your experience, and obviously we're able to hold several different thoughts in the mind at the same time, usually with a sort of distractedness as the citta moves from one to the other. So a distracted mind is one in which the pratyaya consists of many different types of thoughts. But here is something that I find really, really helpful. In dhyana, the pratyaya, the contents of the citta, is not necessarily free of movement. You know, we often think that meditation means that the mind is completely still. No, dhyana does not necessarily mean that the mind is completely still. What it means is that all the vrittis, all the movements of thought, are taking place within the confined area of your dharana. So in the meditation we just did, part of your mind will be moving into the ajna, another part will be moving into the heart. And, you know, there will literally be movement. There might even be thoughts about it. You know, am I seeing a light here? Or maybe I should focus a little bit more clearly on the sensation in the heart. The thought may not be that concrete, but the point is that you will be giving yourself instructions in meditation. Certainly in the dharana stage, and also in the dhyana stage, it's just that you won't be thinking about anything else. In both dharana and dhyana, we use attention and we also use thought forms, ideas, as instruments of our intention. So, you know, the mind might engage the sensations in the nasal passages, then pay attention to the upper palate, and then to the sensation of exhalation expanding and relaxing in the upper part of the head. Or there might be, you know, an impulse to add the mantra. You know, and if you want to add the mantra, I would say work with the mantra Hansa. inhaling you hum, exhaling you sa, or, you know, to direct yourself if you feel tension, may the thoughts soften. And for some of you, there may be this awareness that something is watching, something is aware of the breath. The emergence of the witness, the seer, might begin to occur. So let's go back to the process, to the practice, just for a minute or two. Your eyes are closed. You can firm your posture. Let the sits bones release into the seat. Let the torso rise up through the crown. The breath flows in through the nostrils and you can feel the flow of breath as a sensory experience, flowing up through the nostrils, touching the soft palate, flowing upward into the idea, letting your focus zero in to this place in the center of the head. And so the breath rises and falls in this soft luminosity behind the forehead. And slowly, slowly, notice that you can gently coax the breath downward towards the heart center behind the sternum. Allowing the breath to rise up to the ajna, to fall down into the heart center, and to notice that the space of your dhyana is a kind of circle of awareness that encompasses both. Thoughts arise. You notice your thinking. You let the thought go. And perhaps you notice now, again, really stay with the practice. See if you can be aware how the experience of your focal point shifts and morphs. The nature of the mind is to move just the way the swells in the ocean move, just as air moves with invisible motion. But just as a river is in constant motion, yet confined within its banks, the mind can move within the confines of the focal point and its different aspects, but still be focused in meditation. So dharana and dhyana are never rigid. There's always movement, but it's always within the area of the focal point. So when there's a distracted thought, meaning a thought that takes you out of your focus, you just bring it back. And this is how you develop in dharana. You develop the dharana muscle, the focus muscle. And this is the effort that we need to master the vrittis. The effort is to let, is to stay within the circle of your focus. At first you want a tight focus because that's what helps you become less distracted. But as the process deepens, as the awareness of the ajna and the heart deepens, the focus becomes less concrete, less differentiated, and there's not so much movement. not so much that you're distinctly aware of the Ajna and the heart. It's more that you're aware of the subtle currents of the breath rising from one of these to the other. What starts to happen as dharana gives rise to dhyana is that you actually discover that the vrittis, the thought forms, resolve themselves inside the energy of the mind. And that if you just keep refocusing the mind on the object, the natural process of indrawn awareness begins to occur. Thoughts self-liberate. So you're not trying to control the mind or suppress the thoughts, except through this light effort of attention and awareness. And for those of you who have a hard time getting into meditation, I'll tell you the secret, which is just to sit there until the natural process of dhyana begins to draw the mind inside. And I have a confession to make. When I was first meditating, it took me an hour. I literally would have to sit for an hour before I felt like I was actually meditating. And I got used to just sitting there. My body learned how to do it. And then gradually, I began to notice that the time I had to sit before I felt indrawn became less and less. Until these days, it, you know, takes 3 to 5 minutes before I feel indrawn. And I can actually allow the mind to turn inside, you know, during little meditation snack periods in the course of the day. Dhyana, uninterrupted flow of the mental content towards the object is dhyana. But uninterrupted is a bit of an exaggeration. It's dynamically uninterrupted. That is, the mind is, the vrittis are turning constantly back into the focal point. Now the third aspect of the practice, tad avarta matra nirbhasam swarupa shunyam iva samadhihi. When only the object of meditation shines forth in the mind, without self-consciousness, without the thought, I am meditating, that is the samadhi state. So when only the object of meditation shines forth in the mind, without self-consciousness, that's a paraphrase, by the way, as though devoid of the thought of even the self who is meditating, the hallmark of samadhi, or what I call the shift of state from outgoing awareness to true indrawn awareness, is that you're no longer focused on the thought, I'm a meditator and I'm meditating. You're actually lost in the object. For instance, if you're meditating on a mantra, it begins to feel at a certain point that the mantra expands in the mind and you feel identified with the mantra. If you're doing this practice of engagement in the chakra and the heart center, you have become that inner space that opens as the breath moves between the center of the head and the center of the chest. The mind's egoic function, the part of the psyche that ceaselessly defines itself as me, softens and softens and softens little by little until it gets to the point where it's no longer obstructing your clarity of perception and your ability to become immersed in the object. An object is no longer the relevant word, because you've actually become what it is that you're meditating on. I just want to say a little bit more about how that feels. If you're meditating on these chakras, the experience of segueing into samadhi can feel like a kind of portal that opens into spaciousness. So your experience of the space is as a space, not a particular space, but space itself. And for some people, that opening may, may begin to extend far beyond the body, or it may simply feel as though the outer confines of the body disappear and you're just in this inner space. And for some of you, there are visionary forms, deities and the animals that we see in chakra paintings show up for a moment, lights appear. For me, and I think for many of us, the opening is experienced energetically. So for instance, when the heart begins to open, there's a sense of a kind of expansive swell of energy, which has a quality of tenderness about it that the yogic texts call vishoka. It's the experience. It's one of the forms of yogic happiness. When the head center opens, there's often a sense of luminosity, a kind of sky-like presence. And as we practice in it, the vrittis melt. And the object of meditation becomes a kind of resting place, like almost like a trap door that dissolves into and opens us into the field of our own consciousness. So samadhi is actually the experience of your own innate subtlety, the substratum of your mind, which starts to reveal itself behind the vrittis, to include the vrittis, as the object of focus starts to dissolve into the deeper field of the mind. Now, there are several levels of samadhi, and I suspect that the levels of samadhi might be infinite. The higher experiences of spiritual practice seem to just evolve and expand and get bigger and bigger over the course of time, over the course of your practice. But Patanjali describes two basic levels of samadhi, and he just talks about this in book one. The lower one is called sampragnata samadhi or sabija samadhi, meaning the samadhi in which there is some content present, some cognition present. And that's basically what we've been talking about tonight. The higher one is called asampragnata samadhi, which simply means that there's no content. You're simply absorbed in the subtlest states of the inner world. I want to talk a little bit now about some of the levels of sampragnata samadhi. I'm not going to touch the contentless level of samadhi, mainly because you can't really talk about it. There's no content there. But the sampragnata samadhi types, as you may remember, are divided into the nature of the object we're focusing on. So the first one is called vitarka anugata samadhi, that is absorption in a concrete object, that is to say the upper palate or a flame or a yantra. The second kind is called vichara anugata samadhi, absorption in the subtle state. The third one is called ananda samadhi, absorption in peace. And finally, asmita samadhi, absorption in the I sense. And we're going to return now to our focus. Again, feeling the breath flowing into the nostrils, flowing into the soft palate and then rising to the Ajna Chakra. Exhalation flowing down into the heart. In Vitakka Samadhi, by the way, we often will have experiences of insight into the physical world. The yogic sages believe that when we're in that initial state of Vitakka Samadhi, we begin to receive knowledge about our bodies and also about aspects of the yogic science. The sciences of Ayurveda and astrology are believed to have arisen in the minds of people in Vitakka Samadhi, because it's a state in which the secrets of the physical world start to experience themselves. And it's also the state where you can ask yourself a question, if there's something you need to understand, and insight about it, whether it's a project you're working on or a problem in your family, insight about it will start to arise. In the second stage, Vichara Samadhi. Vichara means reflection, but what it actually means is concentration in a subtle object, like an inner sound, a fragrance, a touch or taste. Obviously, mantra is an inner object, a subtle object. And so are these chakras. So even though we start with a Vitakka meditation on the soft palate, which is obviously a physical object, as the meditation deepens, as we meditate on the felt sense of the Ajna and the heart, we begin to experience these very subtle lights, luminosities. If you stay with this meditation, as some of you discovered during the first class, and hopefully will discover over the course of the next few weeks, you actually begin to realize that there is this luminous presence in the Ajna Chakra, that, in other words, inside your head is a soft light that might be very faint and dim, like you know, the light of dawn, you know, when you wake up before sunrise, this is kind of a grayish luminosity. That starts to dawn in the Ajna. It's one of the fruits of Vichara. In very mature Vichara Samadhi, you can begin to have visions of deities. My guru used to talk a lot about what you can see in meditation. He would say there, the entire world can be seen within the self in meditation. And these are experiences that some people have in Vichara Samadhi. I have a friend who, in deep meditation, sees grids of light that he recognizes as subtle components of the physical world. The states that exist prior to physical manifestation, and which are actually the cause of physical manifestation. Or you might experience the expansion of prana such that you realize that your body is made of energy, or sound your attention flowing into the inner body such that the breath stops and you are being breathed by the subtle prana. As you immerse yourself more deeply in these subtle states in meditation, the third type of samadhi begins to dawn, the samadhi known as Ananda Anugata Samadhi, which is actually the rising of bliss, the rising of peace, the rising of the simple contentment of being inside, which personally, this is my favorite meditation experience. And it's initially Ananda Samadhi may arise during longer meditations, perhaps in a retreat. You often hear people talking about their Vipassana retreat where, for 9 days they are just struggling to keep their attention on the breath, and then suddenly it all lets go and they're just sitting in a field of bliss. This is Ananda Anugata Samadhi. And what begins to happen as this arises more and more, and as you learn to make it a focal point, because you can actually meditate on the feeling of peace, the feeling of subtle joy, it's a kind of gentle happiness that begins to permeate your experience and that you can actually take refuge in during the course of the day. This is actually the experience that has kept me meditating for the 45 years I've been meditating. It's because over the course of the process, the experience of Ananda has become so normalized that I pretty much experience it all the time. And even when my mind is agitated or I'm upset or depressed, there's this current of Ananda that's there, and that what you discover is that you can tune into it and that you can cultivate it as a resting place, and that it actually becomes the place that can hold your whole life experience. The good, the bad, and the ugly can all come and go inside this place of bliss. And as the sense of peace becomes deeper, and here we're talking about samadhi states, not so-called ordinary waking state blissfulness. As the blissfulness in meditation deepens, it segues back into its own essence, which is the state of the pure I called asmita, and you fall into the samadhi called asmita anugata samadhi, which is the samadhi of immersion in your true self, in the true witness. One of the students in this course shared on the listserv a few months ago that she was sitting in meditation. She was actually doing this meditation that we've been practicing this week when her attention began to rise and the top of her head sort of blew off. And she became aware that her ego, that is, that pesky sense of individuality, which never leaves, even in dreams for most of us, most of the time. She saw that the ego was just a thought, that it actually had no reality. It was a vritti, like all the other vrittis, and that it actually arises out of what we could call the great ego, the pure aham, the I consciousness that is part of the absolute, that is the felt sense of being that belongs to the absolute. And she saw that her personal individuality was simply a limited form of the divine sense of being. So this is a kind of advanced experience of Asmita Samadhi. But it relates very much to something that the sages of Vedanta especially say, sages of Kashmir Shaivism as well, that the problem with your ego is that it's too small. When you identify with your limited self, the ego limits you. But the solution to the so-called problem with ego is not to suppress it or beat it up or try to kill it, but to expand it so that it awakens to the realization that it is pure awareness, that it is the experience of no separation. A friend of mine was meditating. The Yoga Sutra doesn't give us experience. It doesn't tell us about meditation experiences. It tells us about the transformations and mind stuff. But as we follow these, we start to realize that our meditation experiences are actually part of these transformations. So one of my old friends shared years ago that when he sat for meditation, he would come up against a wall which felt like the unshakable experience of being a limited person. He said it was like a block. It was like literally like a concrete wall that would come down in his meditation that would prevent his consciousness from expanding. And it frustrated him tremendously. And then one day, as he was looking at the wall, an instruction came up from inside. He said, it said, worship the wall. And so he just, you know, because he was indrawn, he just softened his feeling about the wall. And he began to address it. Oh, infinite wall, your nature is vast. You are consciousness itself. And at that moment, the wall dissolved. And he was in infinite space. So that is Asmita Anukata Samadhi. A couple of minutes we have left. Let's tune into that experience. And here's how we're going to do it. We're going to do it with a very simple practice that can feel like a beginner's practice, but which actually activates this sense of the pure I. So firm your posture. Allow the sit bones and buttocks to become heavy and the torso to rise up from that grounded base. And then begin to say into your own heart, very gently, very relaxedly, the words, I am. I am is the mantra of pure being. And as you think, I am, notice the space that arises, the feeling space that arises at the end of those words. I am. What arises? Stay there, letting the breath arise and subside. And if a thought comes up, return to I am. And then focus on the feeling space at the end of the words. The space that the I am thought kindles in your citta. Again, as thoughts arise, come back to the word, I am. Focus on the space where I am dissolves. And if there's a sense of limitation or any thinking, exhale and let it go.
I am pure being, your own pure being, arising in the space, kindled by this radical thought, this simple thought, this vritti, I am.
I'd like to suggest that you take this process into the evening. Just allow the I Am meditation to kindle your pure sense of being for a few minutes. And just return to it a few times in the course of these next few hours. I want to remind you that you'll get a homework assignment and some study questions that you can work with to help you deepen your relationship to these sutras. And I also want to encourage you to share on the listserv, which is one of the beautiful ways that we can communicate with each other and which allows this community to share the wisdom of the individuals with each other. You know, it's a place to ask questions, to answer each other's questions. I also participate in the listserv. So if you have a question that you don't mind sharing with everybody, put it on the listserv. I will answer it. Again, thank you so much for being here. I'm so happy to be back in this sangam with you all. And I look forward to everything that we're going to be doing together in the next 5 weeks as we segue through the subtlest parts of this text. Namaste. Have a beautiful day, a beautiful evening, and a beautiful week.